Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we ask brilliant educators everything you've ever wondered about teaching English language learners. I'm your host, Liesl Koop. I'm an ENL teacher and resource specialist with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to another episode. Thanks for coming back to listen. Yet another series of Our Burning Questions that teachers are asking a lot about. And I think you're going to find a lot of value in the conversation around Our Burning Questions for today. The questions are, what do all teachers need to know about discourse in order to be culturally responsive? And the second question is, what's the role of literacy, specifically multilingual literacy, in creating more equitable learning experiences for English language learners? I have two guests today who are going to talk about these questions with us. We have with us today Mario Palma and David Burns from the American Reading Company. Hello.
Hey,
how you doing?
Good. Thanks for coming on today. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to ask each of you to introduce yourselves. So, Mario, can I start with you?
Sure.
Can you tell our listeners what your title or your position is in your current role?
Absolutely. So I currently hold the position of Vice President of Multilingual Teaching and Learning. That is one of the roles under the teaching and learning department for the company. I started off as a bilingual teacher in a transitional bilingual model in New York City in the Bronx. And then from there, I was trained on all kinds of language and literacy development practices with the American Reading Company. And after a few years, I decided to go into a larger classroom and work nationally as a bilingual coach. I worked as a bilingual coach for a number of years with the company and then went into a director role that then morphed into what I'm currently doing. I think the primary role that I have with the company is to make sure that our bilingual dual language implementations, where we support schools across the country, are working to achieve results for multilingual learners in those types of programs, but also in other programs, ESL models, where multilingual learners often are placed, that they are seeing academic results as well. So I'm super thrilled to work in this capacity and really feel privileged in many ways, in that I do come in with some information that I hope will change the scope of the learning experiences for multilingual learners, but I also learn a lot in practice with teachers. And I think that that helps me take great ideas that I see and bring them to scale. Another part that I feel really privileged about in terms of my role is how much direct contact I have with our academic advisory board. We have all kinds of amazing researchers, literacy specialists, authors that I get to create webinars with, I get to have deep conversations with, and I've taken a lot of those lessons and applied them as well. So that's just a snapshot of what I do.
Yeah, for anybody who is listening and isn't familiar with American Reading Company, we will link to American Reading Company in the resources for this episode, and you have to check out who's on their advisory board because it is a stellar group of educators. It's really impressive, and there's so much to learn there. Mario, outside of the kind of dual language programming and your experiences, do you have any other special areas of interest or research that you focus on, even outside of your current role?
Well, I think my special area of interest right now is how to navigate crisis home learning. So I talk about this a lot, that I co-parent my little nephew, Johnny, with my sister, and have been for the past 5 years that he's been with us. And I think that that is probably the most important problem that I'm trying to navigate, is how to both respect and value and leverage the learning that occurred in kindergarten that abruptly stopped. Mid-year, but then also redefining what teaching and learning looks like at home. I think there's an opportunity that I haven't really noticed or grabbed, lent some attention to, that's there, that has a lot to do with identidad, with cultural raíces, with the role of storytelling. And I started noticing this when I would try to change his behavior, try to correct some behavior, some unwanted behaviors. And I just started sounding like my mother and noticed that there was a lot of value in that. you know, my mother wasn't someone he ever got to know. So he never really met his abuelita. And so I'm wondering if there's something that I'm not figuring out yet that maybe I haven't tapped into. So that's one area of interest. But beyond and before COVID, I think one thing that I was really trying to figure out was the nature of multilingualism and how this huge demographic shift and this emergence of emergent bilinguals, you know, identify as one, and how we can study the language practices of this ever-budding demographic, this population, and learning a lot from how they use language to achieve their social goals and how we can tap into that so that it can impact the efficiency, the effectiveness of our teaching and learning practices. So that's something that I'm super excited and interested in exploring.
Thanks for sharing that. And finally, what drew you to working with English language learners?
So I'm super lucky to have been born into a bilingual home. Had it not been for my mother who spoke to me in two languages, almost like she was preparing me for what she knew was a fully English system, you know, I would not be here. I wouldn't have had any of the opportunities or privileges that came with that bilingualism. So I think that identification as a simultaneous bilingual always drew me to give back to my comunidad. And I began my teaching career in the Bronx through the Teaching Fellows Program, which was trying to fill this demand for bilingual teachers at the time in New York City, because they knew that bilingual education was something that people were endorsing and supporting the growth of. You know, this idea of working with students that came from the same communities that I came from has always been a draw, kind of a pay it forward and knowing where you came from to make sure that they had the same opportunities as well. So that's really what the attraction was.
Thanks for sharing that. It's your turn, David. David, can you share with our listeners what your title or your role is at the American Reading Company?
Sure. So my current title with American Reading is the Director of Language Acquisition. And so what that really means is whatever the company does in terms of literacy, I really try to put that language aspect, kind of that language orientation lens to everything we do. And it's been really great. I work all over the country, or before COVID-19, I worked all over the country with dual language programs, transitional programs, different types of bilingual education. And it's just like Mario, I'm really privileged to have this opportunity to do this type of work and to make differences in different communities around the nation and to promote bilingualism and biliteracy.
What are your special areas of interest or research within or without outside of your role at ARC?
Wow. Well, I began I have several areas of interest. I think what began my interest was I was really just fascinated by how bilingualism is represented cognitively in people's brains. And so I began to really dig into that research, which took me into formal linguistics and cognitive science. And my graduate studies is in applied linguistics. So I'm not a linguist, but I just play one on TV. I'm just really interested in that type of research. But the cool thing about language is there's just so many different points of entry that you can go in. So I'm also very interested in the social aspects of language and how social cultural theory and how one's social cultural environment affects the type of language that people speak. So yeah, I'm kind of, my interests are broad, but I like that.
Yeah. And just hearing what both of you are interested in I'm just really excited to have this conversation. I can't wait for people to hear your insight and your experiences in relation to these questions that we're going to talk about. David, what drew you to working with ELLS?
Actually, I think it started when I was a little kid. And my next door neighbors were they were a Cuban family. They lived next door. And every summer, their cousins came to visit them from Miami, and their cousins from Miami had just came to the United States from Cuba. And I just remember listening to them speak Spanish and just being astonished that, you know, I was maybe 6-7 years old and I hadn't heard, you know, I was very, very, I guess, isolated, insulated in my own little world. And to experience another language, to experience another culture like that really, really blew me away. And so as soon as I started in school, as soon as I was able to in middle school, I started taking Spanish classes and I was just really enthralled with both the language and the culture. And later on, as I became an adult, I went into education and I still have my love for language, but I was also struck by the inequities that were in the system, specifically relating to multilingual learners. And so I saw an opportunity to kind of combine my two passions, one, language learning, language acquisition, and education and equity in education. So.
Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Let's get into these questions that we're gonna talk about today. Our first big R burning question for today, what do all teachers need to know about discourse in order to be culturally responsive? And to start us off digging deeper into that question, I kind of want to make sure we all have a common definition of what we're talking about as we move forward. So when linguists and language teachers are talking about discourse, what does that mean?
Yeah, so I can think of three different ways in which the word discourse is used. The first is the everyday meaning of the word, which is used to imply what we're doing right now, you know, having a conversation. If you look up the word discourse in the dictionary, the main definition that'll come up is something like spoken or written communication or debate. So that's kind of the everyday use. The second use that I can think of is a bit more technical in nature, in that some applied linguists and language teachers refer to it as speech or writing that goes beyond the word or even the sentence level. So various discourse features of written or spoken language would be, for example, the amount of speech or text, the organizational structure, the density. That's kind of an example of discourse beyond the word or the sentence level. For instance, there's many organizations that are focusing more on that, like WIDA has been really influential, especially among language teachers, and helping them pay more attention to these discourse features, which often form kind of the blueprints of speech or writing. And then the third way of talking about discourse or discourses originated from the work of sociolinguist James Paul Gee in the 1980s. Gee distinguished discourse, lowercase d discourse, from discourses with a capital D. And discourses with a capital D, and this is his words here, are ways of being in the world. They are forms of life which integrate words, acts, values, beliefs, attitudes, and social identities, as well as gestures, glances, body positions, and clothes. So for G, one's discourses make up someone's identity kit, essentially who you see yourself being in the world. And of course, couched within this incredibly broad, you know, encompassing concept of one's discourses is how one organizes speech and written text. But as I mentioned before, it plays a role in many aspects of your life.
Hmm. Thank you for making that distinction.
Wow, David, you have my mind blowing up. This is why I like wake up and drink coffee with this guy every day. Because he just kind of encapsulated what I am trying to work through with my nephew, mm-hmm. is this idea, the relationship between discourse and identidad. And wow. I think that what has unraveled for me through the work of the company and as a teacher is really trying to figure out who exactly I am and what parts of that I brought into the classroom when I taught, and then who, you know, my knowledge of who I'm working with. So my knowledge of the community that I am servicing. So this idea of discourse, by James Paul G, really helps us tease at the importance of knowing oneself and how knowing oneself helps you navigate the kind of discourses that you engage in and the variety, essentially, based on your social goals and who you're interacting with. So thank you, David. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I think that's so powerful. And I think that a lot of teachers who are listening to our podcast are participating in a lot of our professional learning around culturally responsive practices. And so I think that this is really going to be just another tool, another resource for them to kind of think about their own culture, their own discourse, and reflect on that. And we are going to talk a little bit about self-reflection later on, but I really appreciate that. And I forgot to mention earlier that the whole reason I wanted to have you both on is because I heard you both speak about this topic at a session at my sister organization, Midwest Arburn, earlier in 2020. And I found it so fascinating. And so it was one of those moments where you were like, well, of course, like, why didn't I think about that? Talking about different types of discourse. And I think that the message is so simple and yet so overlooked that I think that's why I wanted to make this episode, because I want a lot of teachers to be able to hear this message. So as we're talking about these types of discourse, what do you think teachers need to know about these different types of discourse when they're engaging with students in their room? And Mario, you alluded a little bit to knowing yourself. Is there anything else teachers need to know about types of discourse?
Well, I know David has a few things that he's taught me. One thing in particular for me is knowing how you were raised and what kind of languages and discourse practices you were raised with. So I think what David has taught me in the work that we do and what I've learned from teachers is that sometimes we're really unaware of the impact that our parents had or our guardians or our communities have had in the ways that we discourse, the ways that we communicate. And it's it really centers on the kind of value systems that we were taught. And you know, really thinking below the iceberg, if you can envision culture as that iceberg, or I think Zaretta Hammond uses a tree.
The tree, yes, we love the tree.
And so kind of thinking below the surface, which is probably a lot harder to tease at, but and sometimes uncomfortable to really unpack. But I think until you do that, becoming aware of the type of discourses that you inevitably bring, you know, a certain value system that you inevitably bring into the classroom, you know, I think that that's really, it's going to be really hard to teach the kids that you are afforded to teach until you start with that knowledge of self. David, do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I think it's important to make the distinction between primary and secondary discourses. So one's primary discourse, according to, this is, again, not my words, but James Paul G., a primary discourse constitutes our original and home-based sense of identity, which is usually expressed when one interacts socially with close family and or close friends in a casual environment. So that's kind of what Mario was talking about when he's talking about what type of value system and norms that no one explicitly teaches you this stuff. It's just acquired from just the mere fact that you grow up in a certain place and time. And so I think that that's important to kind of tease out. I mean, the effects of one's primary discourse are really broad and far reaching. You know, it's responsible for everything from the language that you speak and how you speak a language, your vernacular or your dialect. And it's also it could be even responsible for, you know, whether or not you look someone in the eye when you meet them. All of that is really strongly tied to one's primary discourse or their primary socialization experience that happens when you're really young. And then a secondary discourse is formulated outside of one's primary socialization experience. So for an example of one's secondary discourse would be like the behavioral rules and professional values and norms a person must internalize in order to become a part of some sort of community. So like a discipline, like a lawyer, a doctor, a teacher, a bird watcher, a volleyball player. All of these are secondary discourses that are kind of add-ons from your primary discourse. And that's really an important distinction to make in school, because school has its own discourse. School is a, and it's not a primary discourse, right? It's a secondary discourse. So we come, students come to school having already a primary discourse. So having already internalized the system of values and norms and ways of speaking and ways of being in the world that are either a lot congruent with their secondary discourse of school, or maybe not so congruent with the secondary discourse that they find in school. So I think that's an important realization. And it's important to really self-reflect on your primary discourse, because that's often overlooked, because it's just in the background. You've always had it. You were enculturated into that. So it's not something that's usually in the forefront of, you know, people's eyes. So
David, can you help me out with something? I want you to help me figure something out. All right. So I was born into a home where my mother spoke to me in two languages, but she had married someone who was monolingual. He is now passed, my stepfather, Russell. But Russell was also a college educated teacher. There were certain expectations that were made in terms of reading every day, going to the library. But I grew up with English and Spanish being the norm. Like, bilingualism was actually something that we wanted to sustain. We also lived in a pretty affluent neighborhood. And so I didn't really realize that until I would visit my cousins who lived in the South Bronx. So I lived in Riverdale, which was probably one of the more affluent neighborhoods in the Bronx. And then I would visit my cousins who lived in the South Bronx. And there were certain ways that they spoke that were very different than the ways that I spoke at home with my father, my stepfather, and my mother. And so that shaped a little bit of how I started changing how I spoke depending on who I was with, even within my own family. So I always wonder, are there layers to primary discourse, even within that kind of context? Because after I would kind of go away from my family and go into school, I noticed that a lot of the ways that I learned to speak with my father and my mother at home prepared me for the language expectations, linguistic expectations, literacy expectations that I had in school. So that's where that, what I believe you're saying, the secondary discourse piece comes in. But I guess my wondering is, are there layers to primary discourse that I experienced? Because even within my family, they didn't speak the same. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is true for everyone. It's more true for others. For example, in your case, you were speaking both English and Spanish. You kind of vacillated between this world in your primary discourse. Now, again, everyone does that, because the way in which, even when you're growing up, the way in which you're going to speak to your parents is going to be a little bit different just based on the nature of your relationship than the way in which you're going to speak to your brothers and sisters. So even in a very kind of isolated environment, I didn't grow up very multicultural, but I still kind of I still vacillated between the type of language I would use. And this goes well beyond language, right? It's the way I act. It's the way I was, my way of being, I guess, when I was growing up. But a good example that you bring up about, preparing you for school is, you mentioned, I think you mentioned, you were read to. This was something that was an expectation. It was a value. It was a norm in your household. And it was the same. That was the same with me. And it wasn't until I moved to Puerto Rico, and I stayed above. I was in the house above a really amazing family. And instead of the adults reading to the children of the family, it was a really big family. The patriarch of the family would sit at night and tell them just the most amazing, interesting stories. So you can kind of see the juxtaposition there of being in a primary discourse where the act of actually reading and this kind of very linear language that you find in books is valued. And then you find it a little bit different in Puerto Rico, where this amazing, rich tradition of oral language was valued, and those children in Puerto Rico were were apprenticed into that type of discourse from the earliest of ages. So it's kind of cool to see that. It was kind of cool for me anyway to see that the difference in values. And you can say that without saying that one is necessarily better than the other. Because it was just amazing to see that type of rich storytelling going on in Puerto Rico and those children being apprenticed into that type of discourse.
I think the different communities parts of my family, and you mentioned Puerto Rico, I would travel to Puerto Rico quite often. I think that having contact with different types of discourse and communities that speak differently has prepared me to be a better educator, because it gives me this more bird's eye view of all of the varieties of language that we encounter and language practices that we encounter in the classroom. So that way you know how to pivot and leverage. And I think that that's a huge piece that of the work that we do with teachers, is how have you leaned in to the way that that students are using language? You know, what practices in terms of listening to how they're these really intricate ways of using language, how have you leaned into to those practices so that you can incorporate that into your planning and instruction?
I love that question so much. And it just makes me think, if teachers had even the knowledge that there are these different types of discourse, because I don't feel like a lot of teachers get this information in their teacher prep programs unless they are language teachers or they did their undergrad in linguistics like I did, which some ENL teachers do. But that question is so important, that even if teachers just knew there were these different types of discourse, these different ways of being, which I think maybe intellectually they have that idea in their minds, but they kind of don't put that into any kind of practice in the classroom. Just knowing that, I think, would change their approaches to planning and interacting with students and their families.
Yeah. Well, remember, teachers are social cultural beings, just like anyone else. And they themselves are immersed in their discipline, right? The secondary discourse of being a teacher. And so they have internalized the ways of being of teachers, and they're within a particular environment, a particular social cultural space, where there are certain norms and there are certain values that you almost, once you get entrenched in that, you take it for granted. Mm. And then so when a student that has internalized a different secondary, that has come in with a different primary socialization experience and has different norms and values, when those two things hit head on, who has the power? The teacher has the power. So it's like, oftentimes I feel like it's a reaction of, oh, well, what's the matter with this student, you know, or the student is not smart or the student is not, there's a million excuses that sometimes teachers can fall into, because they've internalized the norms and values of the system. And so it's invisible to them, really. Mm. And so that perhaps is one really good reason to study this kind of stuff. Mm.
So when we're working with English learners, multilingual students, we hear a lot, all teachers, I think, if they take any kind of professional learning session about supporting English learners, they talk a lot about background knowledge. Is background knowledge the same thing as primary discourse, or how are those two things connected?
It's a really good question. So background knowledge plays a huge part in primary discourse, absolutely. The amount of learning that students do between between the ages of birth and 4 or 5 years old is just immense. And you know, this issue has kind of came up in specifically kind of dealing with linguistics in the past, with studies that have shown or have purported to show that there's this huge gap, specifically like in word knowledge, right? From students that come from a multilingual background or come from a lower socioeconomic background, you know, the 30 million word gap was a spurred a whole industry of early response intervention type programs. And the thing about that is it really looks at students that come from a culturally and linguistically diverse background as deficient. And it's just not the case. There's been numerous kind of methodological kind of shortfalls that many researchers have pointed out about those particular studies. For example, in the famous 30 million word gap study, the researchers only coded for words that were in the dictionary, which takes out a, you know, which if you talk about a standardized kind of monolingual lens to research, that's it, right? And so this has kind of been co-opted to say, oh yeah, well, these poor students, they come in with no background knowledge, they come in, they have a tremendous word gap deficit, and we got to teach them all these words. And the fact of the matter is that's just not true. And you know, the Louise Moll did is a researcher back in the 90s that did a couple of studies and coined the phrase, him and his colleagues coined the phrase funds of knowledge. And that was the studies that they did, teachers and researchers actually went into the homes of culturally and linguistically diverse students. And they really took the time to learn about the community. They took the time to learn about those funds of knowledge that were present within that particular community. This was Mexican American families on the border in the Southwest. And they found that there was just this wealth of knowledge centered around a whole bunch of things, medicinal, around agriculture, scientific knowledge that wasn't the type of knowledge that was valued in the traditional school system, but nevertheless, this knowledge helped them live and thrive within their particular community. And so it talked about how these teachers use that knowledge to leverage students' background knowledge to help them acquire a secondary discourse, in school. And that's just one of the most basic principles of learning that we've known about for forever, is that we use what students know to facilitate learning into what they don't know. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. That was kind of a long
it does. It does. Thank you.
David, you didn't answer the question at all. I don't know where you were going with that. So this it reminds me of a webinar we just had with Natalie Wexler. She is the author of the book, The Knowledge Gap. And so a lot of the conversations we've had with districts who are trying to identify the qualities of a curriculum that serves the needs of their students has come up a lot. And so she talks a lot about what has resulted in this lack of performance, if you will. She uses NAEP scores, international PISA scores, to prove her claim, and that it's not just necessarily a lack of skills that are underscored in the Common Core or your ELA set of standards, but this lack of background knowledge. And so one of the questions that districts often ask us is how our curriculum builds knowledge. And so this integrated nature of language arts, whether it be in English or Spanish or any other home language that your dual language program is teaching, the integrated nature of that and the sciences and of social studies. But I think hearing David speak reminds me that in order for us to define background knowledge, you have to understand the concept of funds of knowledge, that one without the other, they should be inextricably linked. Because what we don't want to do is to replicate this kind of colonizing system where the only knowledge that is valued is the one that you acquire at school. I think a lot of districts that are figuring this out in terms of what the qualities of a high quality curriculum are, understand the role of parents and families and funds of knowledge to be included, to lift up, to amplify what your curriculum essentially is asking or is in service of students learning in school. So thank you, David. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
And that really brings me to a question that I really want to know both of your answers to. Obviously, I want to know all of these, but some of these come from the teachers that I serve. But I want to know, what's the connection between understanding types of discourse and embodying culturally responsive practices?
Yeah. At the heart of what we encourage teachers to do when working with culturally and linguistically diverse students always starts with knowledge of self. And then by knowing who you are as a teacher, the values and the biases that you bring into your practice, being able to create authentic relationships with students. I think if you don't know who you are or why you became a teacher or have somehow missed or forgotten that, I think it's really hard to be able to build any relationship that's authentic. And if you're trying to teach kids the practices that expert readers do or the practices that experts in all of their different discourses do, you're not going to achieve those goals. So I think knowledge of self is key, both culturally and linguistically. How did you become the person that you are, and what role did language play? I think is a question that a lot of teachers should be asking themselves. Mm-hmm. And how can you use that to be able to understand linguistically and in terms of literacy, the kids that you are servicing? So in order to engage in what we call culturally responsive practices, I think knowledge of self and being able to establish authentic relationships is key.
Yeah, and I do think that in the education system, one of the things, kind of one of the pivots that I agree with is with specifically talking about with the Common Core, is that we're talking about disciplinary literacy. You know, we're talking about literacy that is infused within the disciplines of science, social studies, language arts, math, and so we're trying to coach students, we're trying to apprentice students into these kind of ways of being of the different disciplines that have a specific language tied to them, and that specific language tied to them can either be pretty congruent to how students were brought up in their primary discourse and the other secondary discourses that they've internalized, or it could be incongruent with that. And so I think number one, as far as culturally and linguistically responsive pedagogy and instruction, is to use those students' funds of knowledge, what they come with, to leverage those and use those to help apprentice them into mastering another discipline, right? A secondary discourse. And one of the things too that I want to mention is that never happens unless students are engaged in meaningful, authentic work. So it has to be meaningful to them. It has to be authentic. And if those two kind of touch points aren't hit, then we're going to have a hard time for students at least learning language, because no variety of language is learned outside of meaningful experience.
What I see a lot, and David, I'm sure you can attest to this, is that culturally responsive teaching often becomes kind of the rebrand of multicultural education. A lot of teachers, well-meaning teachers at that, seem to think that it's a set of strategies, mm-hmm. Which it's not. It goes a little bit beyond that. And so this idea of culturally responsive teaching, there's a couple of points that I want to make with this. Sonia Nieto is probably one of the most amazing educators that I've heard speak a few times about what it really takes to be culturally responsive. And she says that a lot of it has to do with how you identify notions of being American, notions of whiteness. She talks a lot about race, and that in order to engage in culturally responsive teaching, you can't take out race from the equation. And so her gospel, what she's taught me really reminds me of Gloria Ladson-Billing's work. You know, she has a lot of roots in the work around culturally responsive teaching, and Zaretta Hammond. Zaretta Hammond talks a lot about the fusion of neuroscience and the work on cognition with culturally responsive teaching, because if we just see it as reading Martin Luther King during Black History Month, then we've really missed the mark, unfortunately. And so Zaretta talks a lot about the fusion of brain-based learning strategies from neuroscience and culturally responsive teaching, that they've kind of been siloed. That the merging of these two worlds is absolutely integral to make sure that we are developing independent learners, not dependent learners. And so she talked a lot about Geneva Gay and Gloria Ladson-Billings, really talking about the culturally responsive pedagogy as encompassing social, emotional, relational, and cognitive aspects of teaching culturally and linguistically diverse students. So what you want to stay away from is that you can kind of put this, make this checkbox, you know, this list. Under culturally responsive teaching, and you're just kind of Xing out the boxes. Mm. What you want to think more about is what is my belief system about how students who are different than me, about how they learn, and what their abilities are, and really question some of the values that may go against what you're essentially thinking in terms of deficit views. I'll give you an example. I was in Oakland, in a school in Oakland. And I was typing up a report after I had worked with a teacher, and a student, an African-American student, I believe she was in third or fourth grade, comes in and she goes, "Hey, yo, Mr. Palmer, your computer's tight." And I sat back and I knew what she meant. But my first response was, "You mean it's cool? You mean it's nice? You like my computer?" And she looks at me really intently and unapologetically and says, "No, I mean it's tight." And I had a moment like, wow, what was I trying to do there? Mm. I literally was trying to change her discourse, correct her manner of speaking, as opposed to just saying, "Thank you."
Yeah.
So, you know, it made me question what my role as a teacher is with students. And, you know, is it to correct? Is it to colonize? Is it to modify? Is it to, you know, reflect on what practices students are bringing into the classroom? What is the role of teaching? Essentially. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think Sonia Nieto, Gloria Ladson-Billings, Geneva Gay, Zaretta Hammond, those are just a few names. Hopefully the teachers that are listening have read some of their work. You can't talk about culturally responsive teaching without talking about their work.
Right. And I'm definitely going to list all of them, all of their names and places where you can find their work in our resources page with this episode. And as you were both speaking, I was just thinking about how Zaretta Hammond says the strategy is the teacher. So it's not a checklist of things. It's your way of being. And it also made me think of, I got to do an episode with Elena Aguilar, who coaches teachers, and how she coaches teachers around their beliefs, behaviors, and ways of being. So it really comes back to that self-awareness and the self-reflection.
So I'm
trying to think about, and this is something that I was thinking about ever since I heard both of you speaking at Midwest Arburn. How can a teacher look at a student's work through the lens of multiple types of discourse? So on that day when I got to hear you all speak, I believe it was Dr. Kathy Escamilla who said that if you're reading a bilingual student's work, you have to read with your bilingual brain. And that really stuck with me. And so I'm just wondering, from your own experiences and from what you've witnessed with other teachers, what kind of self-reflection practice could a teacher engage in to develop that awareness about how their own primary discourse impacts their interpretation of student work?
Well, I think, I'll tell you what I do with participants that you've seen. I think the first step is, and we just mentioned it, is to look at ideology, and because that's very again, that's kind of part of the self-reflective piece. But sometimes there's just a lack of knowledge as far as the type of discourse practices that students bring with them to the classroom, and if teachers, if educators aren't kind of put face to face with the truth, meaning that the type of discourse practices that students bring with them are not deficient, that they are extremely complex. I think that's kind of the first step. So I start off with two examples of students' oral speech. One is Brian, a monolingual white 6-year-old who one day decides that he's going to just rattle off a report about the solar system. And he says this report very linearly, like the Earth moves, so everything else moves. Pluto is the most farthest planet from the sun, also the most coolest. Some planets are dangerous. Some have carbon monoxide, and some have asteroids. And so it's just, this is a first grader who has, only had 1 year of school. And you can tell that his primary discourse, his primary socialization, has been very congruent to the values and standards that we expect in school. And then I compare that to Leona, a same age, 6-year-old African-American student who, I won't read what she, her oral discourse, but it's non-linear. It's in poetic form. It's linguistically, we call it parallel structure, which is typical of like the great epics like Homer, and of the Bible, for instance, uses parallel structure where there's a lot of repetition for rhetorical effect. And there's certain oral language moves that Leona does that is just so indicative of her particular way in which she was apprenticed to speak. And it's very, very complex. And the meaning behind her story, she talks about her grandma and how when her grandma, it was her grandma's birthday, and she ate a lot of cakes, and she actually went against the family and because the family wanted to buy her birthday cake, but she bought it from a bakery and she got sick from that. And so just the immense like metaphorical meaning that Leona put into that, having this matriarchal figure going against the family and then being punished for getting sick. There was just a lot of deep, rich meaning in that. And so to analyze that structurally and to go, okay, this is the move Leona's making. And no, she doesn't consciously know she's making it, but this is the knowledge that she has acquired from being embedded in such a rich cultural dynamic. And so the juxtaposition of those two kids really, in my opinion, opens up teachers' eyes to the fact that, oh, okay, yeah, what I take for granted, which is Brian's, discourse, which is what I take for granted, what I think is the best type of discourse is not. There's a whole different world out there that I need to be open to. And so I felt that that's had some success in kind of opening up teachers' ideology a little bit and being more open to leveraging what students' funds of knowledge, what they bring to to the classroom. Yeah.
Is there anywhere? Oh, sorry, Mario. Go ahead.
There was a book that I just learned about called En Comunidad, and it's a book by Luz Yadira Herrera and Carla España. I know Carla through the work that Christian Solorza from Bank Street School of Education in New York has done. And it's a book about lessons for centering the voices and experiences of bilingual Latinx students. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good place to start to understand the role of what either are liberating or dehumanizing spaces. And I think what David is talking about really alludes to humanizing pedagogical and assessment spaces. And a few tools that Kathy has come up with her work through the Literacy Squared movement. She works out of the University of Colorado Boulder with the Bueno Center for Multicultural Education, and Literacy Squared is the research extension of that entity. And they've come up with all kinds of bilingual tools to be able to assess how students are using English and Spanish when they write. They have many tools, but that's just one that David and I have been exploring with our bilingual team. But I also think that English monolingual teachers in ESL programs have a lot of knowledge that they can glean that I as a classroom teacher never had experiences with. So if I am a monolingual gen ed teacher with a high incidence of language learners, multilingual learners, you know, I think that it's about finding your resources. And there's all this untapped knowledge that I think ESL teachers, TESOL teachers have that I'm not sure the structures in school, PLC structures and things of the like, allow teachers from Gen Ed and ESL to come together to understand how to really equitably assess the way that language learners are using language. So I think Literacy Squared would be a definite resource for teachers that are listening, the En Comunidad book. And then there's another another website, an organization called SEAL, the Sobrado Early Academic Language Group. They're out of California, Northern California. And I remember Heather Skibbins, I think her name is. Shout out to Heather if she ever listens to this, who presented at the La Cosecha Conference, the National Dual Language Conference out of New Mexico. And she shared a lot of tools from the group SEAL that lays out the relationship between English and Spanish and what skills are overlapping, what skills transfer. And I think it speaks to this humanizing pedagogy, this humanizing way of looking at assessment, in that we're looking at the whole child. And so I think what teachers often respond well to is having concrete tools to move them away from monolingual spaces. And as well-meaning as monolingual teachers may be, often can become more deficit-driven because the tools are designed for monolinguals, essentially, and moving into more of these bilingual spaces, multilingual spaces. So yeah, I just want to make sure that those tools are out there. Yeah.
Yeah, and just the mere fact that it's really cool to see how the bilingual brain works. I mentioned that at the beginning of the podcast how I'm really interested in the cognitive representations in the mind of bilingualism. And so the tools that are being produced now are really designed to be able to take advantage of the bilingual brain. And so to be able to have a rubric like in biliteracy in Literacy Squared that has certain criteria, and then it has on one side English and one side Spanish, and you go from just looking at the student myopically, so just looking at the student monolingually, to being able to assess a student bilingually, which is just really cool. So instead of just looking at their language specific abilities, we're looking at their general linguistic abilities as a whole. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a incredible move forward for the education system.
Well, that's the reason why we came up with our multilingual guide. We have a tool that we're really proud of. It's the IRLA Guide to Coaching Multilingual Learners. Mm-hmm. And it takes our leveling system, which is supposed to demystify the learning process of acquiring literacy skills in English into these sizable chunks, but there's more work to that, right? So when a student is learning the language that they're learning to read in, there's more nuance in how to understand the way that they're using language as they're learning to read in that language. And so the guide breaks down critical ways to look at multilingual learner students. And one concrete tool that we have is called the Cold Read Record Companion. And what it asks teachers to do when listening to students read from text in English is to determine, well, yeah, they may be making errors or what some know to be miscues, but why? Why are they making those errors, quote unquote? What insight into the bilingual brain can we glean from that? Are they more language-based errors that can help us understand how they're navigating language, these really rich ways of making meaning with language? Or are they more literacy-based, which would warrant some additional guided reading or small group instruction, things of that nature? So I think the tools that we've been developing as a company are also reflective of the needs, and as David mentioned, this trend in moving into more humanizing spaces and creating tools that really ground what those practices are within humanizing spaces.
Thank you. I feel like for teachers who don't have as much experience with multilingual learners, to me, just shifting to that mindset feels so liberatory. I think, like, okay, it doesn't have to be like you're forcing this English down into this kid. It's about looking at the child and what they bring and how you can cultivate multiple languages and multiple ways of being, as we've been talking about. I think that that's really freeing as a teacher. I don't feel like such a burden to, like, change this kid, you know what I mean?
No, this idea of, you know, the willingness that teachers have to not have all the power, you know, to be the sole keepers of information,
I think is quite liberating. I think the teachers that have had the most success in the classrooms in which we serve are the ones who are willing to relinquish their power and take more of a student role alongside their students. What can I learn from you so that I can become a better teacher? What does it mean to be a teacher? Is more of this co-facilitator, co-creator of knowledge? I think those teachers who have that mentality are the ones that find most success with their language learners. Mm.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's switch gears a little bit to talk about literacy. Since you are from the American Reading Company, we want to talk a little bit about reading. And just, again, I like to make sure that everybody who's listening and everybody who's participating, including myself, it has a kind of common definition about what we're talking. So in your definition, either or both of you, what is literacy?
Wow, okay. I guess I can take that one. So I think the definition of literacy, again, you know, it's such a broad, you know, kind of all-encompassing term. And I think in with the shift that's been happening, like for instance with the Common Core, I think literacy is really needs to be separated into literacies. And so there's multiple types of literacies when, you know, you could talk about it in terms of like, you know, like disciplinary literacies, for example, the types of ways of speaking, listening, reading and writing that is typical within science or social studies or language arts or math. But there's also ways in which people use writing systems in ways that are kind of new and emerging. So we talk about digital literacies, so I think that this kind of traditional concept of literacy as, you know, the reading of Shakespeare and, you know, is, and the classics is really getting challenged. It's getting more, kind of fine tuned, more granular in that sense, and recognizing that different, you know, going back to the social aspects, different groups of people, different people that have been apprenticed into different discourses, use the written word and reading and writing in multiple different ways to satisfy their communicative needs. And so I think that when I think about literacy, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, so I would answer that question based on my experiences with my nephew and some of the ways that he has taught me to navigate some of the skill sets that he has. You know, those are some literacies that I may not have experiences with. So he's taught me how to navigate the world of video games, which I have no clue about. One might not consider video game literacy a literacy that is worth exploring, but I think David, you know, alluded to this, that we need to redefine and expand how we define the word literacy, first by making it a plural. It also reminds me of the work that was done years ago by the New London Group. Some of you may remember some of their work in being able to expand the notion of what multiliteracies are. And they argue this idea of a multiplicity of communication channels, I think is how they mentioned it. And this increasing cultural and linguistic diversity in the world, you know, really is a call to action in terms of broadening the view of literacy. Than is portrayed in traditional language-based approaches. You know, I think the work of literacy within our company is about making sure that students have an opportunity to access multiple kinds of texts, that they have texts that they are interested in, that they want to read, and that they can navigate the printed word to be able to both learn some of the ideas that authors are trying to portray, but then also counter-argue or critique those ideas. So there is some value that I want to make sure, you know, as we're talking about this redefinition or expanding the definition of multiliteracies, there's lots of value, absolute value, in being a productive citizen that falls on being able to navigate print-based literacy. And so how do you do both, right? How do you both make sure that students know how to read and write in the traditional sense? And then also how do you expand what we consider literacies that are worth exploring and learning about? So I think it's a really loaded question, but one that we often start with teachers. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I want to get into some of the questions that teachers ask us a lot as resource specialists with Arburn. The first being, how can I teach my kids reading if they don't know English and I don't know their home language?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I think ultimately this goes back to power, and we talk about power relations amongst students and teachers. And obviously we're going to, as teachers, one of the goals, if we're in the United States and K through 12 public education, is for the students to acquire English. And the thing about it is we know based on research and bilingualism and bilingual education programs that one of the best ways is through a bilingual program. However, if that's not feasible for any reason, we still want to utilize the student's home language in order to help them learn to read. And that requires on the part of the teacher to take the role of the student. So sometimes just valuing the student's home language, the student's native language, making sure that they're able to use it, making sure, even if you don't understand it, right? And for some teachers, man, that's a shock. What do you mean? I'm not going to understand the student? No, it's, well, how do I know? How do I know that they're progressing? Or how am I going to assess the student? So I think first and foremost, you have to be willing to release some of the power, to be a learner. Not that you have to learn the student's language, but to any way that you can value the student's language goes a long way in terms of the student's identity, making them feel like you are there to help them, and that you're that's you accept them for who they are. You know, that's the student's primary discourse, right? So by saying, let's just speak English, or hey, that was great, but you need to speak English now. You're basically saying that the way in which they were brought up is wrong. We get this more often with students that maybe perhaps speak a different vernacular or use, quote unquote words that aren't suitable for the academic space. And teachers say, how can you say that word? That word is wrong. Well, what are you saying to the student? You're saying that the way in which my parents, the student's parents, use language is wrong. Their family is wrong. And there's nothing more demoralizing than that. So I would say that's step number one. And then the other way is finding different entry points to access the student's funds of knowledge, to access what the student can do. That kind of can do orientation is critical. And that might be for the first couple of weeks, the student is drawing pictures. The student is, maybe they're at the one word stage, they're labeling. But really, I would say, don't be afraid to release control a little bit, become a learner, and then also finding innovative and creative ways in order to access the students, access what the student really knows. Mario, you have anything?
Yeah, we've actually created a protocol, more of a process map, if you will, to support this initial figuring out of where the student is at and what skills and abilities they have when learning to read. So I guess one of the first tools is something as simple as having a world map. If you have a world map, you can start to trigger conversations about where the student is from based on their knowledge of their raices, if they are born in another country versus knowledge of where their family was born. I think having a world map is something really simple but can trigger really profound conversations. So do you have that in your tool belt is often what we ask teachers. There's another website that I wanted to share with you. It is called thornwoodps.ca. So Thornwood Public School, Thornwood, Thornwoodps for public school, .ca for California. Mm-hmm. And what the Thornwood Public School District has established are these illustrated books in up to 28 different languages. And the reason why we use this often when we are investigating the literacy skills that students have is because we can find out what their home language literacy skills, if any, are. So this kind of taps into what David was saying. So one, do you have a world map, and what kind of conversations around culture and language and the background of students in terms of their family can you glean from that? And then how can you investigate literacy skills in the home language? So those are two. Another book that we often use is called The 10 Languages You'll Need Most in the Classroom. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that book. And it's by the authors Sundum, Krieger, and Pikowitz. I'm probably decimating that last name. But these three authors have identified 10 most common languages. I know it's hard to say what the 10 most would be because it's all context driven. Oh, there you go, David, you have it. If you have something as simple as that, you know, you can start to not necessarily be an expert in the languages, but at least have some insight. Be prepared. There should be no surprises, right, in terms of who shows up in your classroom. So that would be the third tool. And then the fourth tool is really about how we level students and find out what they can do in terms of reading with the IRLA. The IRLA asks you with language learners to primarily identify what their abilities are in terms of executive function. And there are three stages that the IRLA lays out for executive function regarding English, regarding print. So one is being able to listen to language in a pattern book and being able to repeat that language. Using visual cues to be able to determine words that may change from the pattern. Another one is figuring out if they have concept of word. They know that words are separated by spaces. If they come from an alphabetic language, that might look different than if they come from a language that is not alphabetic. And then finally, their knowledge of phonics and the way that phonics plays, them being able to map out grapheme and phoneme. So those are kind of a bird's eye view of this idea of executive function. And if you can assess if they can integrate those areas, then you have a little bit more insight into what students may be able to do that you can build from. Obviously, you want to know what their language scores are from whatever state or local assessments for language. I think New York State uses the nicest SLAT. And then obviously any observations you might have about the student in terms of their language use. I think if you can figure out a system to put all of these pieces together, you can start to, again, create this more humanizing approach to assessment and pedagogy and a space. Yeah.
Thank you. You just answered like four of my other questions in that. That was awesome. That was really great.
We aim to please here. We aim to please.
and so I'm definitely linking to American Reading Company along with all the other resources that you've shared. And if there are listeners who are interested in learning more about the tools and the resources that American Reading Company has to offer, who do they reach out to? How do they contact ARC? Is that somewhere on the website or does it go by region? How does that work?
Yeah, so I would say first and foremost, our website, www.americanreading.com would be the first website that I would go to. We are really good about putting sample PDFs of some of our materials so you can look through and videos as well. So we have a bunch of videos of how we interact and build relationships that are literacy based with students available on the website. And it's a really great resource just to have at your fingertips. Another way to engage with us is to email us directly. So David and I and our coaches are readily accessible via email. That might be another piece of information we can share at the end. And then we also have our local account managers. Our local account managers really are about building relationships, building partnerships. We're not the type of company to just drop off boxes and wipe our hands and say, good luck, nice knowing you. Mm-hmm. That's not the purpose of why the company was created. You know, we really are in the trenches with our district partners and care just as much about the progress of students than the teachers and administrators have. So we are about visiting schools, checking in with teachers, checking in with principals and district leaders to see what problems we can help you solve through this partnership. So find out who your local account manager is. If you are in the northern part of New York State, Jeannie Cassidy would be the one to contact. If you are more in the New England area, there might be some friends in New England, so Evan Glasson would be your contact. If you are more in the southern part of New York State, then Greg Rotundo would be your local account manager. So hopefully we have, we've got you covered no matter what part of New York State or New England you're listening in from, but there's definitely different ways to keep in contact with us.
That's great. And I can definitely attest on behalf of the Arburns that you are all extremely accessible and responsive. And if we ever have a question about the materials, how to use them, you know, what research they're based on, we always get an answer. And I know that my fellow colleagues at the other Arburns would say the same thing. So we're really grateful that we get to have this conversation and really promote the tools and the experts that you all are, because you have helped us and our teachers immensely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Gentlemen, are there any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap up this episode?
There's a million things I'd like to still talk about, but we'll probably save that for other episodes. I just want to quickly do a shout out. And David, you're a parent too. I have not learned so much about parenting. I've learned more about parenting, let me rephrase that, in the past 2 months than I ever have. I just can't help but feel humbled by the experience of home learning. We're calling it crisis emergency home learning. And so I want to kind of end with the way I started. You know, is there a way, an approach, an understanding of teaching and learning that we haven't figured out yet? Is there an opportunity for cultural and linguistic funds of knowledge to be tapped into that teachers can encourage parents to tap into? There's a reason why this is happening, and there's an opportunity that I think is before us. Is it about recreating what we did in classrooms directly in home? Is it about, as useful as they are, home packets and learning packets? We understand the role that has, and all the equity issues of access to internet and computers. We respect that. We understand it. We know that teachers are navigating. Districts are navigating those spaces as responsibly as they can. But is there something more to teaching and learning that we haven't figured out yet, that maybe parents can take more of an active role? The oral tradition, the role of story, the ritual of story, and all of the lessons. I think, David, you talked about this con el caballero de Puerto Rico that you were listening in. There's something there that I know I'm learning from. And so, we have a webinar coming up on May 28th that Kathy and Manuel Escamilla are going to lead that I'm super excited about. It's entitled The New Normal, Equity and Opportunity for Language, Love, and Literacy at Home. And what we're going to try to do is understand the nature of this new landscape with home learning and how it feeds into what maybe we haven't done enough of before, which is placing families and their knowledge at the center of teaching and learning. What does that look like? What does that sound like? How can we build from it? So I'm hopeful that we can have people on this call, on this podcast, join us for May 28th. It'll be at 12 o'clock Eastern time, because there's something different there that I'm learning from that I still haven't figured out yet, but I know it's powerful.
Yeah, and I just want to add, I second what Mario says, obviously. And, I'm an optimist, even in this situation that's very difficult. As Mario said, we're parents. I have four children, three of which are school age. So they're doing home learning. I also have a 2-year-old. So, things are tough, but I truly believe that with every hard problem, there is an even better solution. And so one of the things that I like about American Reading is we are in the business of constant improvement and constant solutions. And I think one solution that Mario mentioned that's so palpable, that's so salient, is leveraging, in this time, leveraging the funds of knowledge that we already have in our communities, that multilingual learner families have in their communities to foster learning during this pandemic. So yeah, I'm really excited to explore that in the upcoming webinar. And again, thank you so much for your time. It was an honor and a privilege to be a part of this.
Thank you both for joining me. I think there's such a richness here, and you shared so many insights and so much research and so many resources. I can't wait to share these with our listeners. I'm sure some of them are already familiar with many of the names that you mentioned, but it's just an amazing collection of information and shared experiences. I really appreciate you sharing all of that with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the invitation.
And hopefully we'll have another episode together in the future.
Definitely. We look forward to it. And a shout out to you and the Arburn team and all the work that you're doing to service students and their families as well.
Thank you very much. Talk to you soon.
Adios.
Thanks for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guests we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please find those on our webpage. This podcast is produced by Midstate Arburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Sunbeam from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Arburning Questions.